Well, the first question that we should consider is, why should socialists be interested in things like music, art, culture, literature, culture in general? At first sight, these things would appear to be secondary when you have, I think, 40,000 people were just killed in Burma, this hurricane. Millions of people in the world are facing starvation, haven't got a house to live in. So compared to these questions, it would appear that such things as art and music and so on would appear to be secondary. But in point of fact, that's not correct. It's not true if you think about it. Because if you can imagine, let's pose the question negatively. If you can imagine a world without music, without art, without colour, without rhythm, without harmony, it'd be a pretty intolerable place. The lives of working people is bad enough without being deprived of art, if you like. That's true in general, if you think about it. Of course, art is important. Music is important to many people. Music is very important to young people. Music and dancing and so on. I'm not referring to the quality of the music. I won't express an opinion about that. I'm not qualified to do so. But that it is important to people, you better believe it. In the same way that sport and football and so on that we were discussing earlier is also important. Because otherwise people's lives are so drab and so empty and so meaningless. Without that, it would be human existence would be completely intolerable. So it is important even today. But it's my contention that a long time ago, in the origins of human society, music and art were much more important to people than what they are now. You see that if you care to examine any of what some people term primitive society, societies that are in a different stage of social development to ourselves, people that are still living in tribal society, in parts of Africa or Amazonia and so on, and you see the central importance there of certain forms of art, and specifically music and dancing, which played an absolutely crucial role in the ritual existence of these people. Now, what you see there, and what must have been the case under tribal communism, which is the earliest form of human existence, of human society, at that time we find a very strange state of affairs, something which perhaps is difficult for us to understand now. That art, science, and religion were all one. There was only one culture, and it was all the same thing. Take art, for example, these wonderful cave paintings. Incidentally, that's an interesting point. Many people have asserted, and there's some truth in this, that you can date our human existence, our humanness, from the appearance of art. It's the same time, it appears. This wonderful cave art, by the way, this art has never been equaled, in my opinion. These wonderful, vivid descriptions of animals, bisons, have never been equaled. And you see, nowadays, I'm looking at the wall in this room, I can see paintings, wonderful paintings, and so on, very, very attractive. But they're put there, they might be there, they might not be there. They're put there as an ornament, something attractive to look at, something to fill the space. That was not the case with this cave art. Because what people don't realize, first of all, people didn't actually live in caves at that time. If they did, it would have been in the outer part. They probably didn't even live there, but in huts or shelters or whatever. But the question is, where is this cave art? It's not in the outer part. No, it's not at all. It's in the innermost recesses of these caves, in the darkest part of the cave. Incidentally, just imagine the effort that would have been required to paint these things. Well, the only light you'd have was perhaps a bit of rush dipped in animal fat. Crawling on your belly, because some of these places are very inaccessible, to paint with colours made of crushed plants and so on, and berries, this required a colossal effort. And what wonderful results. It's astonishing that they could achieve such aesthetically pleasing results. To us even today, it's aesthetically pleasing, although we don't understand this art. It is impossible for us to look at these paintings and see what those people saw. Because clearly this art is not an adornment, it is not an ornament, it is not the fairy on the Christmas tree, it is something important. So important that they went to extraordinary lengths to do this thing. Now, this, of course, this art clearly was for a practical purpose. It wasn't there for an adornment. It wasn't something trivial. It meant something, and what it meant, as far as we can gather, I know there are different theories on this, was it was also an effort to control the environment, to control hunting. For example, the type of animals that you see on these cave walls, it's not any animal. We know, for example, from the remains of bones, we know what these people ate. And one of the common things was there were reindeer. But there were hardly any reindeers in these depictions. They're not the animals that are depicted. The animals that are depicted are other animals. Bisons, bears, mammoths. Why is this? The answer is quite simple. It was a very easy thing to track and kill a reindeer. Reindeer has been semi-domesticated to this very day. But a bear or a bison or a mammoth is a hard animal to kill, and therefore magic was required in order to acquire power over these things. So clearly that is related. It's like sympathetic magic is called. So here is a kind of religion in a way, a kind of spirit world, but there's also a practical side to this. It was intended for practical purposes. It was intended to give the hunter power over these animals. The same applies to all other art forms. Dance, for example, plays a big role. It's at that stage in human society, it's a ritual role. Some of these dances imitate animals. Quite a few of them imitate animals, and probably again were designed somehow to improve the hunting skills, to acquire power over these animals by imitating them. But then, of course, that's the earliest form of art, which we can only imagine or guess at its significance. But all this changes approximately 10,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, in what is arguably the greatest revolution in the whole of human history, which is called by the great Australian archaeologist, anthropologist, Gordon Child, a Marxist, by the way. The father of modern archaeology was a Marxist, Gordon Child. Wrote some wonderful books like What Happened in History and Man Makes Himself. He described this as the Neolithic Revolution. And here is basically the transition from a hunter-gathering communistic mode of society, which private property was unknown, to settled agricultural society. The reasons for this probably to do with climate change. It's a very popular subject these days with some people, climate change. So it seems. Well, it's not the first time we've had climate change. There was climate change at that time, and it led to a change in the patterns of animal migrations. It must have made hunting animals more difficult. And certain other activities, for example, raising crops, which are actually an invention of women. Women invented agriculture. The women, insofar as one can work out, would have dealt with this side of things. The greatest revolution in history. It forced people to live in settled communities. And there was a transformation. My first observation is this is an economic transformation. And every great economic transformation, every change in the way in which men and women produce their means of existence, also produces changes in social formations. It led, in this case, eventually to the rise of class society. For the first time, there's the crystallization of rich and poor. It led to big changes in ideology and culture and ideas. Ideas follow this. Changes in ideas follow these changes in the in the mode of production, to use a Marxist expression. And therefore, for the first time, you have organized religion. There was no organized religion before. There were no professional priests before. There was no special caste of priests. Anyone could be but certain people that were considered to be skilled or apt for this would become a shaman. But they were not separate. It wasn't a caste apart from other people. They worked and hunted the same as the rest of the tribe. Here, for the first time, you get a state, a priest caste, a king, and of course, art changed. You get religious art. This is for the first time you get a caste of artists. So that art and religion and culture, for the first time here, that's the point I'm driving at, becomes separate from the people, becomes something specialized. This is also to do with the intensification of the division of labor. And above all, the enormous division of labor between mental and manual labor. There was no such thing in the Old Stone Age. In the Paleolithic period, there's no such thing. Here, for the first time, you have specialized certain people who do certain tasks. The person that creates metals, the person that... As they say in the Bible, the hewers of wood and drawers of water, which is the majority of society, are reduced to the status of forced labourers or semi-serfs or whatever you care to call them. There's a bureaucracy. There are people who can read and write. Writing is a powerful weapon. Culture in general, you must understand, culture is a powerful weapon. Engels used the following expression. That in any society in which art, science, and government are in the hands of a minority, that minority will use and abuse its monopoly in its own interest. Now, in that little expression, you have the essence of class society. How does this affect art and music? Well, it does affect it. There's a fundamental change here. Most of the music of peasant societies is, if you look at it, it's work music. It's music, it's rhythmic, and the rhythm is intended to not to imitate animals, as used to be the case, which is also, if you think about it, related to the mode of production of a hunting society. Here you have, most peasant music has got a powerful beat to it, a powerful rhythm, which is to do with working. If one takes, for example, you mentioned jazz earlier on, Mark, if you think of the music of the American blacks, the black slaves, it's got a powerful beat to it. Partly it's taken from African society, of course, but it's undoubtedly it's work music. It's rhythmic. You have other examples like sea shanties, you know. So this is music of work, of a basic character. Alongside of the popular music, however, and you get popular folk songs and so on, which is a peasant culture, which has existed for thousands of years. You get the culture of the ruling class, the art of the ruling class, and the music of the ruling class, which is increasingly separate, it's increasingly divorced from what goes on at the base of society. Now, we have to understand that no matter what one thinks of class society, and it's not up to us to take a moralistic attitude towards history, no matter what you think about this, It did act as a powerful stimulus for the development of culture. Aristotle, I was going to talk about him tonight, but we'll talk about him on another occasion. He said in his book, The Metaphysics, he made a marvelous expression. He said, man begins to philosophize. He didn't say women, because women didn't count in ancient Greece any more than the slaves. They weren't considered to be human. But he said, man, we can add women to that. Man begins to philosophize when the needs of life are provided. And he went on. Consequently, mathematics and astronomy were discovered in Egypt because the priests did not have to work. That's Aristotle said that, not Marx. A wonderfully profound materialistic idea. And it's true. Marx makes the point that the ruling ideas, the most advanced ideas of every period, are the ideas of the ruling class. Note what he said. He doesn't say all ideas. There are other ideas. But what he said, that the ruling ideas, the leading ideas, are the ideas of the ruling class, of necessity. Because it's the ruling class that's got the time and the facilities and so on to be to develop culture, if you like. And that's a progressive thing. It's progressive that, that these people developed culture and art and music for a long time. But this art and this music also reflects tendencies in society. Now, what is wrong, and some people, I've got a wrong idea of Marxism, some people think that, I've heard this so many times, one gets a little bit tired of it, but people say, oh yes, Marxism is obviously wrong, because Marx reduces everything to economics. Marxism reduces everything to the productive forces. How many times have you heard that statement? Entirely false. Entirely false. Marx and Engels explain this is nonsense. How on earth can you reduce everything to economics? It's not possible. There are many other things apart from economics in life. There's religion, which is an important force. There is art, there's culture, there's music, there's philosophy, there's politics, there's ethics, there's morality, you name it. All kinds of things, which are not economics. What Marx and Engels did say, and it's absolutely true, and doesn't admit contradiction, is this, that in the last analysis, the viability of any socio-economic system depends upon its ability to develop the means of production. Yes, they did say that, and it's true. Because in the last analysis, even artists and dancers and film stars and so on, philosophers and priests and popes, they must eat. They must have shoes upon their feet. They must have houses to live in. And therefore, in the last analysis, the viability of any socio-economic system depends upon its ability to develop the means of production. That's true. But the relationship between the development of the productive forces, the economic base of society, if you like, and the ideological superstructure, including art, music, and so on, is not a direct, automatic relationship. It's indirect. It's very indirect. It's very complex. It's very contradictory. It's not easy always to ascertain. But it is there. And there's no two ways about that. For example, if one takes period of Rome and Greece, we don't know much, since I'm supposed to be talking about music, we don't know a great deal about the music of Rome and Greece, although I've got a record in the house of what is purports to be Greek ancient music. They think they've deciphered it, but I don't know if it's true. But all of this anyway came crashing down with the collapse of the Roman Empire, the collapse of the slave system, the entry of the barbarians, and the commencement of feudalism. Now, if one takes medieval Europe, feudal culture, that's different again to slave culture. Slave culture was, by the way, that's an interesting idea. Slavery is something that's, to us, something absolutely repellent, something that's inhuman. But let's not forget that it was through slavery, and thanks to slavery, in point of fact, that you were able to get this wonderful Greek art and science and culture that we depend upon. It was thanks to slave society that this developed. With the collapse of slave society, you get a different kind of production, feudalism, which is based upon agricultural production. And in Europe, all of culture throughout the Middle Ages was dominated by one thing and one thing alone, and that was the Christian religion, the church. Culture, art, and music were entirely under the control of the church at that time. And again, it became somewhat distanced. Gradually, there becomes a distance between the aspirations and lives of ordinary people and this sclerotic culture organized from the top by the church, by the hierarchy, and so on, which ultimately leads to an explosion in the form of the Reformation, which was a revolutionary movement. It coincides with the birth of capitalism, actually. Capitalism is born in the towns, first of all, in the north of Italy. It's not an accident that the Renaissance starts in Italy. Art starts in Italy. Incidentally, I don't know if you ever thought about this, there are no portraits in ancient art. Portraits start with the bourgeoisie, with the Reformation. Capitalism is based upon the individual, on individualism, and therefore individuals have their portraits painted, which never was the case before. In Italy, then in Holland, which took the form of a revolution against the Spaniards, then in Britain, with the English Revolution in the 17th century, all of this had a powerful effect again on art, on literature, and on music. Finally, of course, the French Revolution of the 18th century, where for the first time capitalism now becomes implanted as an entirely new system based upon individual capitals, first of all merchant capital, and eventually the Industrial Revolution in Britain. Now, all of this has its reflection. For example, take music. Music in the Middle Ages, of course, you had the peasant music, that's always there, as the bedrock. It always hasn't changed very much in many respects. If you listen to the kind of folk music which I'm well acquainted with in the Balkans, in Bulgaria, Greece and so on, it's very similar to the music that was played in Britain in the Middle Ages. Peasant music, it hasn't evolved a great deal. The most advanced music at that time was the music of the church, the religious music. And, of course, this also entered into politics. It entered into the revolution. Luther, apart from being a leader of the German rebellion against the Catholic Church, if you like, also, as Engels explained, founded the modern German language. He translated the Bible into marvelous German. He also wrote hymns. He wrote music. And those hymns, by the way, were revolutionary songs. I'm thinking of one in particular, I don't intend to sing, don't be alarmed. Ein fester Burg. In English, it's translated as a safe stronghold, our God is still, a trusty shield and weapon. These were Engels described that song as the Marseillaise of the 16th century. And these were revolutionary songs. And then, of course, you get the whole of Europe divided at that time along religious lines, but the religious lines were also class lines, were also political lines. Politics was dominated by religion. Protestantism is, or was, the religion of capitalism, of the bourgeoisie, of the rising bourgeoisie. The hymns of Luther were revolutionary songs. On the other hand, the other half of Europe was dominated by the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, which staged what was known as the Counter-Reformation, which, by the way, had an effect on music. They restricted, for example, they wouldn't allow, they were very restrictive in relation to music. They'd have to know the content of it had to reflect the doctrine of the Catholic Church and so on. So even in the field of music, in the Reformation, you get the clash between a revolutionary art and a revolutionary type of music who's coming in from the rising revolutionary class, and the other side, which wanted to suppress this and crush it. Finally, of course, the bourgeoisie triumphed, above all after the French Revolution.